Chris Stanzel with Empower Hour.
And I'm Victoria Zamatello with Empower Hour.
Today we have a very exciting episode, positive for once, and that is we're talking about voting rights in the United States, specifically the For the America, wait, what is it? For the People Act 2021.
And speaking on it, we actually have a special guest. So one of our own, actually, we will be having Brandon Reese on. He's actually a member of Empower Hour. I'm not going to lie, I don't remember what position you hold,
Brandon, he has done, he is the behind the scenes man, and he does all the cool stuff.
He does everything.
The amazing logo you guys see for every episode is custom made by him. As well as all of our social media. And he also happens to be definitely more than me, and I'm a political science major, knows a lot about this stuff. And so I think we're going to have a very good discussion today about this. And like I said, it's positive, right? You know, we're always doom and gloom. So let's talk about some positive change.
This will be a nice change of pace.
Exactly. Also, even though most people will probably be hearing this long after, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Absolutely.
I'd just like
to point out Chris is the only one not wearing green right now.
Yeah, I mean, my shirt's kind of got that striped look. You know, like that meme not too long ago where it's like, what color is it? So, you know, it's a turquoise. I'm going to say it's a turquoise. So it's sort of.
Yeah, green. I think if you were talking to like a colorblind person, you could probably get away with saying that it's like a very faded mint.
Yeah, it's so. For the sake of the holiday, we're going to call it a turquoise. I love the Victoria's wearing these wonderful green suspenders. So like, that's the whole, like, she went all, like, whole nine yards for this.
Yeah, come visit me at Miller's Ale House now that I'm serving and taking tables and stuff, I guess. I don't know.
But before the meager wages of of the capitalistic system.
Oh, absolutely.
We shall be talking about democracy. So I think without too much more delay, I say let's go ahead and go right into that interview. And we are back. Brandon Reese, our very own. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Excellent. So why don't you kind of give the audience a little background? I'm sure first on kind of what you do at Empower Hour here, and as well as kind of your interest in voting rights in the United States and you know, so maybe any expertise you might have.
Yeah, so I am the co-founder and public relations director for Empower Hour. It's been over a year now since we've been sitting in the Rights Union Food Court, putting this all together. Who would have known that 1 week after that is when we went online for because of COVID. But yeah, that's basically what I do. I make the graphics, like you said, you know, just working on the website after this and whatnot. But in terms of democracy, I am president of Democracy Matters on campus. It's a nonpartisan student org that focuses on big money in politics, you know, representation, equity, all that, criminal justice, basically the intersectionality of big money and all of the major issues that our country is facing. So one thing that we do is we advocate for public financing of elections. We try to get people to show up to vote, especially in local elections. And right now we're working on a lobbying campaign for the People Act of 2021, also known as HR1. HR1's a special designation. The Speaker of the House gets to pick which legislation will be HR1. So Nancy Pelosi has picked this one, this pro-democracy legislation, as the sort of major bill for the House, even though they've already passed the American Rescue Plan that's become law.
Democracy matters. Brandon, why does democracy matter? And why does this bill matter? Why should it matter to the American people?
I knew you were going to ask that question. I always say, why does democracy matter? That's the question that I think our generation is going to be confronted with the most. Right now, we're seeing an election where a candidate won a majority, an outright majority of the popular vote, but some are claiming that he is the illegitimate president. Now, I'm not here to advocate for Joe Biden or anything specifically, but that's worrisome. because this election was secure. The Department of Justice said so. And that was Trump's Department of Justice, I believe. It was the Department of Homeland Security, I'm sorry. So right now we have to sort of reform our elections in order to address the major issues like climate change, like criminal justice, racial justice, healthcare, guns. Those all intersect with big money in politics. And when we take on big money in politics, we're referring specifically to private money and corporate money. So we don't think money should be taken out of elections entirely. We just think that the public should have more of a role in that process. Because right now the Supreme Court, their basic understanding is that money in elections, spending money in elections is free speech, but not everybody has access to the same amount of money. So in other words, that case just that the Supreme Court has said that everybody has a different level of free speech, which our organization fundamentally disagrees with. So that's why we advocate for a public financing election. That's a broad term. There's different approaches to that. You could have like a system where I donate $5 and the state government triples it. So that sort of magnifies it a bit, whereas like a richer person can just donate the $15 to $20 anyway. So they're probably going to donate more. or there's other systems where they give you like democracy dollars because alliterations are cool. And you basically, they send in the mail and you write down which candidate you want to send it to and they get the money. So it's more than just voting. You're investing in a candidate. And research shows that when you're investing in a candidate like that, that you're more likely to sort of be engaged and not just vote and forget about it after that. So yeah, we're trying to take on that distortion, ensure that the will of the public is not drowned out by bigger money and bigger forces. So the For the People Act, that's like one of its three main pillars, is to address big money in politics. And so it focuses on things like disclosure as well. And it addresses super PACs. You know, that right now Facebook ads, you know, you don't really get to see who owns them. Now that's gonna be law, you know, if this passes. So it also creates public financing elections at the state level. Florida already has it, but it's not popular. So it's sort of, it's investing in these programs that already exist, and they really don't provide a tax burden to the public. It's really $10 a year, pretty much. That's the increase in taxes that you'll see. So it's really, it's not that hard to process, but there's opponents who claim that, oh, you're violating free speech. Like, no, we're making free speech equal for all.
One of my questions is, I saw when I was reading about it, they were talking a lot about filibustering the Senate. And that's honestly like, that's the most that I've heard about this act in the news recently, because I know there's been a lot of talk about some kind of filibuster happening. But for those of us, myself included, who aren't exactly well versed in just political diction, what is a filibuster? Like, what does that involve when people use the term filibuster in reference to the For the People Act?
Yeah. So in general, the filibuster is in the Senate. And right now the House has time debates, but the filibuster is essentially because the Senate doesn't require time debates. And so right now a 41 vote minority can filibuster any issue and prevent a vote from, you know, getting a vote on it. Prevent legislation from getting a vote. So basically right now, everything, it's sort of impossible because the Democrats have the majority, but they don't have 60 votes. So they can't really legislate. So we're kind of still deadlocked in a way, which is quite interesting. And there's also, it's easy to get rid of the filibuster too. You could just have a simple majority change that, but you have people like Joe Manchin who are Republicans in disguise, that claim that they're not gonna end the filibuster, that they wanna keep it the 60 vote. And then Joe Manchin, I was just reading an article right before I joined y'all. He's flip-flopping on this issue all the time. He says, oh, I don't wanna get rid of it, but I want it to be more painful. I want people to stand up until they collapse. Like you saw in the movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And then other times he's like, no, we're gonna protect the rights of the minority. But protecting the rights of the minority is sort of another way of saying, I don't want anything to happen. I wanna maintain the status quo. So the four ongoing crises that our country is facing now, which is COVID, the economic uncertainty, racial inequality, and climate change, we're unable to address those unless they're budgetary measures. So the reason why we were just able to pass the American Rescue Plan and all that COVID relief is because we used a process called budget reconciliation. And that was a rule created, I believe, during the Nixon administration that says you could use a simple majority to pass anything that relates to the budget, federal spending, taxation, et cetera. But you can't really change law in itself. So that package, that's why the minimum wage got gutted out, because that really doesn't relate to the federal budget. And a single parliamentarian made that distinction. So a single parliamentarian is responsible in a way for keeping people with starvation wages. But on the other hand, it's the 41 vote minority that's unwilling to bring this to a vote. And it's also some Democrats, I'm not gonna blame the Republicans entirely. Bernie Sanders tried to do an amendment to put it on there just to force people to say whether or not they support a $15 minimum wage. And I believe it was 7 or 8 Democrats voted against a minimum wage increase. And one of them, Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, sort of like did a dance when she voted no. And she's gonna be up for a reelection, I believe, in about 3 or 4 years. So I think it's 2024 when she'll be up for reelection. So that could harm her. People will remember that. I mean, it's a GIF and everything now, or GIF, depending on how you say it. So the filibuster is hurting the For the People Act because it's not a budget bill. Well, there's some budgetary things on there, but it's not entirely related to the budget, like COVID. You know, where it, there's not really a dollar value to say, oh, we need to protect voting rights. So the fate of that legislation right now is pretty much dead in the water until there's reform in the filibuster. You don't necessarily need to blow it up, but you could do what Joe Manchin said. You could make it more painful. And there's other proposals out there, like that would require 41 senators to stand in the chamber continuously and sustain that 41 vote threshold in order to block the legislation, which eventually we all know is impossible. You know, they're gonna have to leave to go to the bathroom or something. And even if they did shifts, it would eventually sort of lean out. So right now, for the People Act, it's not going to pass unless we get filibuster reform. And in terms of the long-term consequences, not just related to what the bill does, but people vote based off of, like, retrospectively, based off of how the administration's doing. And so you could see increased volatility in elections because people are going to put all this blame on Biden, which is warranted to some extent. And the fact that he's not able to do the major things that he promised, they're going to blame that on him, not the Republicans who are obstructing it. I mean, every Republican voted against the COVID relief package because they're obstructionists, despite the fact that their constituents supported. I mean, polls show that Democrats and Republicans supported that COVID relief and the stimulus checks, but they're just being obstructionists. But Biden gets the blame for it. So we could see a completely a different administration in 4 years. And given that one party is, you know, sort of embracing white supremacy a little bit more, that kind of scares the hell out of me. So the filibuster is sort of just like the For the People Act. It dictates the survival and the quality of our democracy.
Wow, this is very thorough, Brandon. I feel so big brain right now just listening to you.
It sounds like a broken record.
Future,
like 60 times a day.
Future Harvard professor. Which would be enough
votes to end the filibuster. Let me add that.
Well, not to get too off topic, but could you maybe give us a little bit of how did the filibuster even come to be, or why has it become such an integral part of our voting system in the first place in Congress?
Yeah, so the filibuster, I like Barack Obama's characterization of it. He called it a Jim Crow relic. So the filibuster was used to protect the segregation in the 1960s. So I can't think of the exact senator's name right now that did a filibuster opposing the Civil Rights Act, but it was the longest filibuster in American history. It was almost a day long. In the end, he did not convince anybody to change their mind, and the legislation still passed. So it was merely a tactic to delay legislation. And in a sense, you could say it kept segregation, you know, for a day longer. So add that up, you know, you're really protecting the status quo here. And the status quo is harming people. I mean, we're still dealing with some of the problems from the 1960s today, you know, and that's why we have the Black Lives Matter movement. We still need to address these issues. So the history of the filibuster is not a pretty one. And the fact that you see both Democrats and Republicans trying to defend it is quite scary, because like I said, it's life or death at this point. And we're reaching a point where now the other side, I am liberal, but the other side, the conservative side of the aisle, they're going further and further to the right. So if we don't end this filibuster to make meaningful change, then we're going to eventually reach a point where that type of government exists for at least 2 years. And that terrifies me.
So I don't know how many people. Filibuster?
I'm sorry?
How does one end a filibuster?
So you could reform it. I mean, you could blow it up and just say, nah, you know, we're going to just vote on a simple majority, which I kind of like. But it does protect the rights of the minority. Because if there is really controversial legislation, you should be able to oppose that, even if you're in the minority. But given that you see now it's very polarizing and they're obstructionists, you know, that's not how it's really being used. But how do you end it? You can either reform it or end it. And the reform side of the aisle, you just basically, like I kind of hinted at earlier, you could make it more painful. You could have them stand up and do it. Right now, it's sort of indirect. So there's the way you overcome a filibuster today is with a cloture motion. And a cloture motion means you have 60 votes and you're just going to proceed and vote on the bill. The Republicans will obviously, you know, object to that motion. In the future, it could be a Democrat or whatever. But given that we have a Democratic majority, the Republicans would be the one opposing it. If you make it a little bit more painful that someone has to stand there and talk, they're going to be less willing to do so. You know, you don't have to just go to the Senate and say object. You have to stand there and talk. And I mean, the record is like 23 hours and almost a day. And it's really not going to stall anything for that long. But right now, given the way it exists, it stalls it forever. So you have to make it more painful in order to sort of nullify its effects.
So switching gears just a tad here, when we are, let's kind of engage a little bit of a congressional speculation. So the bill that we have right now does seem to protect a variety of, it seems to address a variety of different voting rights issues. However, one that I, at least as far as I saw, is not being talked about is voting rights issues when it comes to U.S. territories and specifically D.C. and Puerto Rico. Now, it's no secret that they are being underrepresented. And in the case of territories such as like the U.S. Virgin Island, Guam, they literally can't vote at all. So do you know if there's any kind of talk about addressing this or even, you know, doing something like making D.C. a state, since that would effectively create two new Senate positions for what would become the most diverse state in the union?
So the For the People Act does include that support DC statehood. And right now, the non-voting delegate for Washington, DC has already signed on 215 co-sponsors, not for the People Act, just in general for DC statehood. The For the People Act doesn't specifically address Puerto Rico, but Puerto Rico just recently did like a non-binding referendum and a majority said, yes, it's time for statehood. So this would admit them to the Senate. So you would have, if both Puerto Rico and DC became states, you'd have 104 senators. I'm not too familiar with the politics of Puerto Rico, so I'm not gonna make any claims on that, but DC is overwhelmingly liberal. I believe Trump got less than 5% of the vote in the presidential election. And that's about the extent of DC's representation in the federal government. They can vote for presidential candidates. They have three electoral votes. But they don't have a voting member in the House, and they don't have any Senate representation. And in fact, their license plate, if you go, it says taxation without representation, which is obviously a reference to the reason this country was founded, that we were being taxed without representation. So that's one of the voting rights reforms that the For the People Act has, that it would give them better representation in the federal government. And also, just to be specific, because I'm a nerd, there would still be a part of DC that wouldn't become state. So like the downtown area where the Capitol building is and all that, that would be, it's still its own district, because the Constitution says so, that the seat of the government can't be part of any state. But there's a lot of suburban areas in DC that the federal government really doesn't operate in, that people live in, and they don't really have the chance to vote. I'm about to head to grad school in DC, and I've already told my family, I'm like, can I stay registered to vote here? Because, you know, it would be nice to have some representation in Congress. Plus I'll probably be coming back and forth anyway. So, but in terms of other voting rights reforms that the For the People Act has, it does affect gerrymandering, which is another big aspect as relates to representation. Because right now, congressional districts are basically drawn based off of the party affiliations of the people living in that area. And so, and to some extent, based off of the race as well. So there's racial and partisan gerrymandering. Right now, we're about to redraw the districts because we just did a census. And that census count probably isn't perfect because it was also at the same time as COVID. So states that have complete Democratic control, so their governors are Democrat and their both houses and their legislature are Democratic, they have complete control over writing it, and they could favor it towards the Democrats. And Republicans have complete control of the state government, as in Florida, for example. They have complete control. Now, I don't want to use Florida as too much of an example, because some states, and I don't know which ones off the top of my head, do have independent commissions that draw them. But basically, CNN's already reported this, and Democracy Matters has discussed this in one of our meetings. The Republicans control enough to basically draw enough districts for them to take back the majority in 2 years. So regardless of what happens, you know, even if Biden fixes this pandemic overnight and he sees the same boom that George W. Bush did after 9/11, they could still take back the House anyway. And they're probably going to. I mean, statistics show that after 2 years of a presidential administration, that you sort of see the midterms are like a referendum on that president. It tends to flip. That's what happened in 2018. That's what happened in 2010. It'll probably happen in 2022. Unless we pass this, then all states will have to use an independent commission, which means it'll be fair and square, which is quite nice. And that's probably my favorite part of the bill, not going to lie, because the fact that you can change a majority in Congress without, you know, addressing the will of the voters, that's not democratic at all. So to some extent, answers your question earlier, that's why democracy matters, because we have to make sure that it's our votes being reflected in government, not people with an agenda.
So one of my questions is, everything you've described so far sounds like something that's just frankly impossible to oppose. And I get One of the shitty parts of legislation is the fact that the For the People Act is like, what, 800 plus pages?
And wouldn't be surprised. I don't have the exact number.
Somewhere in there has to be something that isn't necessarily related to voters' rights. And like, I guess something that like, I know there's an actual term for it, but where they actually squeeze in something else in order to get more support from more centrally aligned Congress members. What are those things in the For the People Act?
What are the hidden asterisks in this bill?
Yeah, what's in between the lines?
Right. I mean, I've been looking through it, and I haven't seen anything that's clearly partisan, for example, so that they're trying to sort of get Republicans to oppose it. You know, it is a bipartisan bill. Like the majority of the public, I have the exact numbers here. About 56% of Republicans alone support this. Of course, more Democrats support this. And then independents are in between. So a majority of the public supports this, just as the majority of the public supported COVID relief. But the bill has three pillars. The For the People Act has three pillars, and that's to get big money out of politics, make voting simpler, safer, and fairer, and to hold public officials accountable. That's how the Declaration for American Democracy likes to categorize it. To some extent, the sneaky stuff in the bill, I wouldn't think comes from Congress people. I think it comes from the lobbyists. Because, I mean, there's a book by Lee Drutman that goes into corporate lobbying, and it just shows to the large extent that politicians depend on lobbyists in terms of writing bills. So, you know, politicians aren't experts on this stuff. But lobbyists can do the research, and they can sort of use their leverage to get the bill to change. Also, this isn't necessarily the final form of the bill. So we could see some sneaky stuff in the Senate if it ever gets to a vote. Because if you look back to the American Rescue Plan, they were, for a simple piece of legislation that was largely already written, they were voting for about 12 hours. Well, technically 24, but they were really stalling for 12 hours on amendments specifically. And all the Republican amendments got shot down. It was just to delay. And that one change that was made in that was to appease Joe Manchin, because he's sort of, you know, if he opposes, the Democrats can't pass it because they have literally the bare majority. Given that the Democrats introduced this in 2019 when they first got back the House in the Trump administration, and they reintroduced it again this time because Mitch McConnell didn't even bring it to a vote in the last congressional session. It seems like this is something that Democrats will probably jam through. It's been a priority for a while, but I wouldn't call it a Democratic bill. We'll see if there's any changes in the Senate, but right now it's pretty clear that this is something that they've just been waiting to pass for some time. So I wouldn't question its motives that much.
We saw a fiasco when it came to the Democratic 2020 primary, and we'll likely see a similar fiasco in the 2024 primary for the Republicans, et cetera, et cetera. Do you know if there's any verbiage in this bill that addresses primaries specifically, or is it just focused on like general elections?
So the bill doesn't directly impact primaries, because that's sort of up to the DNC and the RNC to figure out. So the undemocratic superdelegates in the DNC that sort of destroy more progressive candidates and, again, protect the status quo. It seems like there's a lot of mechanisms to protect the status quo. That would be up to the DNC. And the DNC does have a new chairperson. I think it's Jamie Harrison. He just lost to Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. I don't know too much about Jamie Harrison, so I'm not going to discuss any points. But I know back when there was the election for the former chairman, Tom Perez, you saw candidates senators, like Bernie Sanders supporting a DNC chairman like Keith Ellison, who's now the Attorney General of Minnesota and is working on the George Floyd case. He supported Ellison while the establishment supported Perez, and Perez prevailed. And then they made like this reform where if nobody gets enough votes on the first ballot based off of primary wins alone, then they'll do the superdelegates. And given that there were so many candidates in 2024, if COVID hadn't happened, the likelihood of a contested convention like that was extremely high. But again, back to the For the People Act, there's really no direct changes to the primary structure on the party side, but these voting rights changes will make primaries a little bit more accessible to voters. So like it expands voting by mail. It creates a nationwide standard for early vote, because, you know, right now election day is on a Tuesday and it's not a federal holiday. So a lot of middle-class workers and lower-class workers who are just getting off of work, they don't really have the motivation to go vote after that. But early voting sort of breaks that gap. I've always voted early. I don't think I've ever voted on election day. And that's because I vote with my family and they can't vote after work. They don't have the time. You see other democracies around the world, they vote on Sundays. That's amazing. But early voting is available on weekends. But this would create a nationwide standard because right now it's really up to the states. And you see like Florida, like the day before election day, most counties don't have early voting, which I think is weird. Like, why do we have this one random day where we can't vote? So this nationwide standard sort of streamlines it a bit. It would apply to swing states, red states, blue states. So that's nice, which could sort of change the results to some extent. It wouldn't really favor a party, but it would just be more representative of the population because more people have opportunities to vote. There's a separate piece of legislation that Democracy Matters is going to be talking about in the future, so I don't know too much about it, but it's the John Lewis Voting Rights Act or something like that that addresses, it's like a modern day version of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that sort of ended disenfranchisement of the African-American community, you know, the poll taxes, the literacy tests, et cetera, et cetera. The Supreme Court struck down a key provision of that. And there's recently, I don't think they've reached a verdict yet, but the Supreme Court was hearing arguments again on the Voting Rights Act of 65, where conservatives were trying to strike things down and bring it back. I mean, you kind of still see here in Florida, for example, that sort of Jim Crow era of voting rights, where we just voted overwhelmingly so, bipartisan, to restore felons' voting rights. But Governor DeSantis is like, no, you have to pay your fees and restitution. That's a poll tax in everything but name. That's a poll tax. So the For the People Act does give felons the right to vote in every state. And I don't know if it has specifics on whether or not there would be such a poll tax, but the fact that you're re-enfranchising people who were locked up by, modern day slavery policies of Nixon and Reagan with their drug wars, they're getting their voting rights back. And that's how you change this country, is making sure that the people who can't vote and who are hurting the most by the status quo, give them the right to vote, empower them, pun intended, because empower hour, empower them to vote. So that's sort of what this bill addresses. Like, you'll see the Republicans say, no, you know, this is like the first step towards abolishing the Electoral College. Good, let's abolish it, because right now someone who votes in California, their vote counts less than some white person in Wyoming. And yeah, Wyoming's white, let's just say it, you know. So the Electoral College is racist. Let's acknowledge that. It needs to go. When you see Republicans trying to obstruct this, I mean, you really know their motives. This isn't a bill that tries to help Democrats, because Democrats aren't necessarily on the right side. I mean, the Democrats, they're doing drone strikes and stuff. They're killing civilians still. They're taking the money from, you know, military contractors. Some Democrats are taking money from the NRA. So it's not a policy that favors one party, but it does favor the American people who are sick and tired of taking it as it is and want to see some fundamental changes in this country.
Excellent conclusion.
Yeah. As we kind of start to wrap up here, Victoria, I don't know if you had any other major questions to ask.
No, honestly, I'm good. I think this was like a great way to just expose all of our listeners to what's going on here. Cause like, I personally didn't know what was going on before I started doing the research about this, like at 3 o'clock leading up to this episode.
Not to leave it on a negative note, but Brandon, if you could just tell us, what do you think the likelihood of this bill passing within the next year or some variation of this bill passing in the next few years is?
I would say in general, it's unlikely, but I do believe that the Biden administration recognizes that that people want tangible changes. They want to see it. They don't want just these symbolic changes anymore. And you could just tell that because, I mean, he in his inauguration address, even down to the design of his Oval Office, he's been trying to say that he's focused on unity. he's trying to frame himself as an LBJ FDR kind of guy, where they made lasting changes to this country that we are better off today because of it. So he's trying to position himself as that type of president. You know, he's kind of already skewing away from the Obama era economic policies. He's more open to taxing the rich. We'll see if that actually happens. But he's also, yesterday, he hinted at in an interview that he would support filibuster reform. This is one of the oldest men in government that was in Senate for years until Obama chose him as vice president. You know, you think he would just want to keep everything as is because he loves the institution so much, but he favors a more painful filibuster because he wants to do the more transactional aspect of policy. I mean, he just passed the American Rescue Plan, and right now he's on like a tour to tell everybody how awesome it is because it's the most progressive bill we've had in this country from an economic standpoint. And that the fact that he's trying to sell this to the people, whereas the Obama administration didn't sell their stimulus package with the 2008 recession, shows that he's focused on this this transactional relationship. And when he says bipartisan, he doesn't mean that he wants to work with Republicans necessarily. He just wants to support what's popular, because let's be real here, majority of Americans are pro-choice, right? Majority of Americans want affordable healthcare. Majority of Americans know that climate change is a real thing. So that he's sort of really focusing on that relationship with the people. And given that this bill, as I said earlier, is widely supported by the public, I think that the outlook is looking better each day, especially since yesterday, because he supports filibuster reform. Mm-hmm. And I think he's going to work with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to try and not end the filibuster, but reform it, make it more painful. And once he does that, then this bill will finally get a vote and it will pass. Kamala Harris will probably have to break a tie, but they both have said that they support this legislation. And there's a bunch of other legislative priorities as well. You know, one bipartisan issue that Biden wants to address is infrastructure. It creates jobs as well. And the Republicans are probably going to vote against it because they want to be obstructionists right now. But like I said, his form of bipartisanship is focused on what do Americans want. And you really haven't seen that in a president. I'm actually quite surprised, because he did in the primaries portray himself as this establishment Democrat that said, oh, nothing. He literally said nothing will fundamentally change. But then when he was sworn in office, you sort of see a different vibe. So I do think the outlook is good. And that means the outlook for our democracy is good as well.
I'm going to take you on that positive note, Brandon. I'm going to hope for the best on this.
Don't blame me if it fails.
So I think with that, I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up. Brandon, thank you so much for coming on. And of course, thank you for all the work you've done for the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great.
So with that, I have been Chris Stanzel with Empower Hour.
And I have been Victoria Zamatalo with Empower Hour.
And we will see you guys next time. Thank you for joining us.
Thoughts, questions, concerns, you want to tell us how much you like the show, you know where to go. Email us at host@empowerhourradio.com.